Hello, listeners, and welcome back to This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture, a podcast of the Black and African Diaspora Forum of Monmouth University. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. We have Dr. Manuel Chavez, a lecturer in the Department of World Languages and Culture at Monmouth University. He's also the director of the philosophy program. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chavez.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
Well, thank you so much for taking out time and your schedule to join us on the show. So today we're going to discuss the philosophical and intellectual legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and with a focus on the concept of love, which has been, you know, a major point of discussion in philosophy, but also intellectual history, which is my own field. I'm very interested in this concept and teach a course on this concept as well. We all know the contributions of Martin Luther King's. We know his legacy and his contributions to American history, society, and culture. But he also made important philosophical, I would say, interventions and contributions to the Western intellectual tradition, as well as the African-American prophetic tradition. I want us to get into some of that as we discuss this concept of love as understood by King and who wrote about the concept and spoke about the concept. But the structure of our show today is we'll discuss Dr. Chavez's educational research and teaching background in part one, as well as the course that he teaches at Monmouth University called Love, Life, and Liberty. And then part two, we will get into a more in-depth discussion of love and the ideas of Martin Luther King. So Dr. Chavez, please tell us some more about your educational teaching and research background.
Sure. I did my undergraduate studies at Truman State University. And it's there where I found my love for philosophy. Originally, I was planning to become an engineering major, but after my first semester, I had a course in Intro to Philosophy. And I just was taken with the questions that were being asked and thought about within the context of philosophy. After that, I changed my major and I pursued it through graduate school. And it's been a way for me to rethink who I am in a deep way. So philosophy asks fundamental questions about who we are, what is our society. And for being Mexican-American student, you know, in college, it was really important for me to sort of figure out where I stand, you know, where's my place in the world. And philosophy sort of provided me the tools to do that, to sort of pursue those questions in a deep way in terms of knowledge, in terms of politics, in terms of history. And I just felt like philosophy was such a rich area. And so I pursued it till I got my doctorate with the mentorship of Dr. Maria Lugones, who recently passed away. And, and I decided that this is something I also want to teach. And so I've been teaching at Monmouth University since 2013. And so where I teach the intro courses to philosophy, and I also teach Love, Life, Liberty, as you mentioned. So philosophy has been, for me, it's something I believe, you know, everybody should consider, should study, should understand in order to have a very critical view of our world today. So,
I think you answered my second question already, but I want to talk about that a little bit more before we talk about your course that you teach. What can philosophy do for us now in light of the recent events of January 6th, essentially a white supremacist assault on the state of the government of the United States? And how can we make use of philosophy now in the moment?
Well, I think philosophy forces us to ask, like, why is this happening? You know, what are the causes? Where is this coming from? What is the worldview of the people who engaged in this riot? You know, why do they think their freedoms are being taken away? Why do they think their government is being taken away? And so I think philosophy sort of allows us to get up at those deep questions about identity, about value systems, about epistemology, about ontology. I think what we see happening today is clearly still a legacy of segregation. I mean, segregation, of course, has been outlawed on the books, but there's still like a segregated reality that we're living in, where you have one part of society that sees the world as, you know, coming from a particular history where it's, you know, it's one that moves from, you know, the pilgrims to the pioneers, and it's a history of complete freedom. And then you have another view of reality that sort of sees the underside of that narrative, that sees who's excluded from that narrative, recognizing that this hasn't been a history of freedom, but it's been a history of exploitation, a history of dispossession, a history of genocide. And those segregated realities, are being played out today. And I think it's going to continue to play out the rest of the century, really. And so philosophy sort of recognizes that the issues is simply more than just public policies and political campaigns, but it's really at the level of, you know, what is reality? What is knowledge? And so it's no accident that one of the main issues today is this idea of post-truth, of alternative facts. Mm-hmm. The issue of epistemology, like people, you know, it's important that those are at the center of politics now, you know, like what counts as reality, what counts as truth. And I think philosophy sort of brings us to those questions and gives us the tools to sort of think about those questions.
I'm glad you brought up some of these concepts associated with philosophy. So my field, intellectual history, actually is in part, you know, I think comes out of literary theory and philosophy, and as well as political history. Intellectual history, at least at the moment, is very much influenced by those fields. Talk to us a little bit about these words, epistemology, episteme. You know, our audience might not be familiar with those terms. I'm sure many of them are, but right. I think it's useful to do that.
Sure. So epistemology is usually considered to be like a branch of philosophy. So epistemology is the study of knowledge. It's answering the question, what can we know? What counts as truth? What counts as knowledge? Who is a knower? How do you become a knower? So all those questions are like fundamental to the field of epistemology. So epistemology is concerned with trying to distinguish between opinion and fact, you know, recognizing, you know, or trying to determine what counts as genuine information versus inaccurate information. And so epistemology is thinking about what we know, thinking about our own knowledge and how we get that knowledge. And the way it's playing out today, and this is something I think Martin Luther King himself also talked about, that when it comes to social movements, it's important to be intelligent in your actions, to be a critical thinker. And so to be able to recognize the biases of one's own point of view and to try to go beyond those biases. And critical thinking tools are important to make that transition. And if people are not aware about the limitations or not aware of their own biases or not aware of their own partiality, then they'll fall into this trap of thinking that their view of reality is the only reality, that their understanding of truth is their only view of truth. And right. So quickly, people who are not familiar with epistemology or questioning knowledge can easily fall into a trap of like, a form of fundamentalism, you know, not just religious, but a philosophical fundamentalism, where they simply refuse to question their own assumptions and see any questioning as a form of attack of their own assumptions. And so epistemology, when it's pursued, is supposed to sort of like unsettle us in that way, to make force us to sort of think about what is it that we actually know.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think about one of the videos of the terrorist who was thought he was going back home from Washington, D.C. And now the video has gone viral of him at the counter in the airport, mm-hmm. trying to get on the plane. And they said, "No, you, sir, have been placed on the terror watch list. And he's in a rage. And he says, me, they've made me a terrorist. Me, they've ruined my life. And he's fallen into that trap wherein my truth is the only truth. And his reality is one thing, but it's to the point now he's at a point of crisis because he's like, how could I be the terrorist?
Right.
So philosophy has, I think, can be applied, right, to our daily existence.
Absolutely.
You know, if we were so inclined. And I think absolutely what you say here, we're in some ways, talk to us about this epistemological crisis, because I think we are in a crisis of knowing and of knowers, you know, as college professors who get pushed back or placed on the professor watch list. Mm-hmm. For asking our questions in the classroom, mm-hmm. for asking our students to think.
Right.
So I've been reading a little bit about, and I tend to agree with that view. We are in this epistemological crisis. What can be known? What is the truth? And who are the knowers?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how I think originally the problem, at least posed within the discipline of philosophy, is how do you question authority? How do you question tradition? So that has been like the starting point I've noticed in like a lot of philosophy textbooks. But I think the major problem now, the crisis they're referring to, is that people don't know what to believe in, or they simply believe that, you know, everybody's perspective is of equal value. And so there's this like relativism, epistemological relativism, that I think dominates now in popular culture, where somebody can, you know, assert some claim and feel that they should not be questioned because it's their experience, it's their knowledge. And the danger of that, of course, is that critical thinking cannot occur. You know, if you're simply defending your own position and you feel like you never should be questioned, then how do you know your own position is correct? How do you know if it's accurate? How do you know if it's fair or it's a good interpretation of what's going on? And so I think that's the major issue, is this relativism, where people are not sure how to think about their own thoughts. They're not sure how to think about their own knowledge. They just assume that what they know is true. And I think that's what's happening. It's interesting, like after the internet, you know, became a major technology in society, there was this assumption, you know, this modernist assumption that the more information we have out there, it will necessarily make society somehow more intelligent, that it would make society more rational once people had more information. But as clearly as people have, as it's occurred, as it's played out, is that people need frameworks, people need paradigms, people need a way to interpret that information. And I think that's been lost, or is a major cause of this crisis, is that people are not sure which framework they should be using to take in this information. And the only framework that they end up using then, of course, is their own subjective experience, their own subjective opinion, the opinions that they get there from their, you know, their families, from their own, you know, homogeneous communities. And so they never learn to question that worldview. And really, they don't have the tools to do that, unfortunately. And so when they do encounter, you know, an alternative narrative or an alternative perspective, they're not willing to engage it. They're like, okay, well, that's their truth and I have my truth. I won't question their truth as long as they don't question mine. So there is no evolution of thought. There is no development of critical thinking. There's no right. development of, you know, pursuing some common perspective on reality. And so you lead to a very fragmented understanding of reality, where everybody's opposed to the other. And the only way to interact with the other, if there is interaction, is through adversarial means. It's by attacking the other, by trying to defeat the person who's questioning your perspective. And unfortunately, you see this on social media all the time. I mean, I see it with my friends from high school. It's like they have their allegiances, and these allegiances are part of their identity. And so if you question their viewpoint, you're basically questioning their own personal identity. And then they get offended, insulted, and they basically, you know, shut down. And when it comes to race, I mean, this is even more problematic, of course, is because many white people never questioned their white identity. They never questioned their whiteness. And so when you question their worldview, when you question whiteness, they really, I've noticed, are unable to think through the issues. Like, they are unable to think through the question. And so they either attack the other person who's questioning them, or they simply just cut off themselves from other people that have alternative perspectives or have alternative experiences. And so this, I guess another way to sort of think about the crisis is it's an intersection between relativism and whiteness, where whiteness cannot be challenged because it's simply one perspective among many. And it's assumed that whiteness is just as valid as any other perspective without recognizing how whiteness is constructed, how whiteness is tied to the logic of power, how the history of whiteness is linked to, you know, the history of dehumanization of non-white peoples. Like, that is made impossible to be looked at within the current crisis that you're referring to. So I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, I think it's a powerful way to illustrate where we are and how, you know, philosophy might be applied to the moment. And the interesting thing, which takes us off our subject a little bit, but I think it's important because of what has just happened in this nation.
Yeah.
There is within this discussion of relativism and so forth, not a critique of modernity, but a critique of postmodernity, of postmodernism. Postmodernism is at fault for this fracture. And we must, right? It's postmodernism is dead. We're done with that. But what we really should be doing is critiquing modernity, because race and nation march together through modernity.
Right.
And this notion, it just as what you just said about the internet and how, you know, science and reason must be elevated above all things. And if we just have more knowledge, that comes out of the Enlightenment tradition. That comes out of modernity.
Right.
That's not postmodernity.
Right.
But the critique is we've deconstructed everything. And so henceforth, that has led us to fragment. And that's in the fear of, and that's why it's important, I think, like you said, is to think about whiteness and how folks really need to sit down in the segregation of history, the segregation of knowledge. Yeah. And this is why African-American history should be taught everywhere. Everybody should have a course on African-American history.
Absolutely, yeah.
And critical race theory, because it'll give them the necessary tools they need to wake up from mythical thinking or magical thinking.
Right. And they'll be able to see, they'll be able to gain a perspective outside of, you know, what is white epistemology. They'll be able to gain outside the perspective of how the nation state was created, you know? So this is what, you know, studying African-American history and culture a lot, you know, provides the opportunity to sort of develop that, I'm not sure outsider perspective is the right word, but definitely a perspective from the periphery, a perspective that's not from the center. And so I think that's, yeah, I absolutely agree that the epistemology of the institutions of the university also has to be changed if we actually are going to deal with the rise of fascism that's happening in our country right now.
Right, which is an outgrowth of modernity. That is what is at fault here, right? And so when the postmodernist mid-20th century is saying, you know what, your faith in science, this is what it brought us. And yeah, it's a very interesting conversation.
Yeah. I mean, there's, of course, different types of postmodernisms and different types of modernisms. But I think sort of like the thread of this is, of course, is capitalism and how capitalism structures knowledge, how capitalism structures our value systems, how capitalism constructs our identities. And I think modernity is an outgrowth of capitalism and colonialism as occurred in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. And postmodernism in some ways is a critique of modernity, but I think really what it points down to is like a critique of capitalism. And unfortunately, we don't have the tools to talk about capitalism, at least in larger society. or if it's automatically seen as, you know, necessarily as socialism, as communism, as a big threat. So it's interesting that, how dominant epistemologies doesn't provide that space for thinking about how to look at our economy in a critical way.
Yeah, it's, I don't know if you saw that recent tweet where someone said when Twitter decided to cut off Trump's account, the Google workers have begun to organize and they've created a union. And right. So the Twitter workers were putting pressure on Jack and they were saying, you know what, 300 of us, we don't want this guy on Twitter. And so this tweet basically argued it was the organization, these workers were organizing behind the scene that were putting pressure on these big tech companies, to say, we're not going to take this anymore.
Right.
And so that's a very interesting narrative that's unfolding. So let's turn to your course, Love, Life, and Liberty, and let's bring in our discussion of Martin Luther King. I think King is at the crossroads of these various, I think, philosophical traditions, because he's drawing on Western philosophy, Black liberation theology, Christian theology, Eastern philosophy. I think he is, as a public intellectual, I mean, one thing I wanted to do with this show is to demonstrate to our audience that Martin Luther King was more than a preacher, teacher, and activist. He was a public intellectual. He cared about ideas. That's and right. How ideas might be applied in public spaces. So tell us about your course, and then tell us about how you bring Martin Luther King into that course.
Sure. So the course, Love, Life, Liberty, is, it's a work in progress. I'm constantly changing it from term to term. And clearly, the way I approached it was, given my background, is through philosophy. But I tried to include, disciplinary perspectives, of course. But what ties it together is philosophy and how, love, life, liberty, how they're interpreted, how they're constructed, the history of those ideas, how they evolved over time, and looking at how they intersect with identity, how to intersect with social philosophy, political philosophy, ethics, morality. And so the course is really to get students to sort of think about these three important terms. And so the main focus the last few years has been on love, in part because when I've noticed students don't see love as something worth thinking about, they just tend to assume that love is just a mere feeling and it just happens between two people, that you don't have to think about it. And so there's a very Western idea that, love is purely an emotion that's separate from one's mind. And so I try to trouble that. I try to have students sort of think about love as an intellectual project, it's worthy of, to sort of think about, and recognizing that love does have a philosophy, that love has a particular structure of meaning that shapes it, that makes it distinct from other emotions. And so that's been the main focus, but also the meaning of life is, of course, another important question, and the meaning of liberty, which I've been trying to expand a little bit more as well, to sort of have students think about what counts as freedom. Because I think that's also another, core concept in our society that students assume they know, but they never really thought about. And so they just automatically have, this idea that freedom is simply the freedom to do whatever you want, but it doesn't go deeper than that. And so I've had to sort of expand on that question in my course more recently, especially in the last, two or three years, about the meaning of freedom in our society. But love still continues to be, I would say, the majority of the course that we look at. So we look at different philosophers, different thinkers, think about, debate, what is the meaning of love? And so we do somewhat historical examination of how love, the idea of love, has changed over time. And also having students think about, what can love mean in the present? And so this is where Martin Luther King's work is so relevant and important, is that he was thinking about love in the 20th century, in the context of social change, in the context of politics, And so he's been a great way to introduce students to, you know, like to recognize that love is a lot, is a phenomenon much more complex than just merely a pure feeling or emotion between two people.
Yeah. You know, I just a few years ago started this course on love and marriage. And I'm actually going to reconceptualize it because I think I took on two big projects in a single course that really, I think, are so big that it's hard to contain a history of love and marriage in a single course. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of tweaking that course a little bit and probably going to focus more on love. And like you said, it has a history. It's an idea. It's more than emotions. There are multiple forms of love. I think when a lot of my students in that class, they think about, so I bring Martin Luther King into that course as well, and his writings and ideas about love and how love and like are different. And Simon May's book, I use History of Love, and he starts to talk about how you have these examples of people. I can think of one case where this woman was working in a maximum security prison, and she falls in love with one of the prisoners. And one of them was a mass murderer. He killed more than, you know, two or three people. And she falls, quote unquote, in love with him. Meanwhile, she's married, right? And so he brings up in that book how, well, you don't necessarily have to like somebody that you fall in love with, right? Just thinking about romantic love. Right. It's just, I think students think about romantic love when you raise the issue of love.
Right, right.
That's probably one of the, you know, eras that King spoke of. And I was thinking of one of his speeches that he gives on love, and he's talking about how you don't have to sit down at the table with the person you love if it's agape, right? Form of love. It doesn't mean you have to like the person that's hitting you over the head, but you love them because they are human. And so tell us a little bit more about how King grappled with the concept of love, and also how he draws on, you know, what traditions does he draw on? Or maybe even talk about what documents of his that you use in the course.
Yeah. The main text that I've been using, it has been his essay called Loving Your Enemies. And I use this essay because I think it really, it's where he tries to get at the core of this idea about the meaning of love and how it relates to his larger philosophy on nonviolence. And so this essay, I think, provides sort of it's where he lays out love as this way of being. It's a particular, you know, logic of that's in love. And so this essay that I've been using is one that he also, where he believes is what defines Christian love, you know. So, you know, clearly his, one of his main inspirations in his politics and his ethics and his thinking is, you know, Christianity and Christian philosophy. And so he recognizes that within the concept of love is where you find the radical core of Christianity, where Christianity is no longer simply just an institution, but becomes a way of resisting oppression. And so, he asks, you know, what does it mean to love your enemy? And this is something that he quotes somebody, quotes the Bible from the Gospel of Matthew, where Jesus talks about, it's, you know, you've been asked to love your neighbor, but I'm asking you to love your enemy. And so Martin Luther King asks, like, what does that mean? Like, how can you love your enemy? Why should you love your enemy? And so it's in this essay where he tries to, you know, think about why it's important for not simply all Christians, but anybody that wants to address oppression, who wants to address, you know, segregation, racism, must, you know, confront and sort of think about how love operates in this resistance. And he does a nice job in this essay of, like, you know, making that explicit when it comes to love. And I think that at the core for him, love counters the logic of hate. So what I've noticed in, you know, in the general, you know, dominant traditions of philosophy, when they talk about love, love is usually seen as, in apolitical context, again, within personal relationships. But for King, love is already happening within the situation of oppression. So the question is, okay, how does love look like within a situation of oppression? And so in Love Your Enemy, of course, one of the assumptions is, you know, it's clear who the enemy is. And I've noticed when students read this essay, they're not sure who the enemy is. And the enemy that King is talking about is the person who dehumanizes you, the person who doesn't see you any value in your life, who doesn't value your existence. And so he's asking us, we have to love that person. And why should we love that person? Ultimately, it's because if we don't, if we end up hating our enemy, we're simply reproducing the same logic of oppression. We're reproducing the same logic of dehumanization. And so we're stuck in the same situation. So even though we might defeat our enemy, we end up reproducing the same conditions of dehumanization. And so for him, the logical love allows us to sort of escape that cycle of violence, that cycle of hate, and creates a different situation. And I mean, is it idealistic? I think Martin Luther King was trying to be careful, and he's very explicit. Like, he believes this is a very practical thing, this idea of love. Because in practice, for him, love is not utopic. Love is something that you have to, you know, actually do in the moment of resistance when you're encountering your enemies. And so the whole point of love, as he argues, the goal of it is to transform the situation of oppression, ultimately. So your enemy is no longer somebody who's trying to dehumanize you, but rather you can see that they're not pure evil, but they see that they are themselves are persons. They're faulty persons. They're persons who are, you know, ignorant in their understanding of the situation, misunderstanding you yourself. But through love, you can change the situation. You might not be, and again, as you point out, the whole purpose is not to like the person. The whole purpose is not to, you know, make them your friend necessarily, but the whole point is to change the situation and transform it into something that humanizes all of us. And it's in this essay that I think he like lays out that logic, lays out that structure, that love has the power to do this if we sort of pursue the logic as he lays out. And many students react to it in different ways. I mean, some students think it's impossible, while other students recognize that there is something there that then we need to consider, especially in contemporary society. So,
yeah, especially now, I think it also makes me think about Reverend Curry, who gave the speech at the royal wedding of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And when he started to go on, and they were like, well, you know, this is over 15 minutes. What does he think he's doing? He's grandstanding. But he was bringing King into that discussion of love. Mm. And he said several times, now that's power. Now that's power. And obviously drawing on Christian ethics and philosophy for King and, you know, Curry, it's Christian love. They're talking about Christian love, a particular type of love that has its own history, too.
Right.
And obviously, we know King is drawing on, you know, the Christian philosophy, Christian theology to make his case about love. But at the same time, I think he's straddling a lot of different traditions, especially when he talks about love as power. And I think that's what Bishop Curry was actually saying, that this is a powerful force.
Right.
Right. If we're saying that, well, love can be defined, it's an idea, it has a history, it's an emotion, it's many things. Talk to us a little bit about this idea of love as power, love as strength. The strength to love is one of King's major writings as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in that same essay, Loving Your Enemies, he does refer to Nietzsche. And so Nietzsche, in his own works, who was very critical of Christianity of his times, believed that love was a weakness. And clearly Martin Luther King, you know, was arguing against that view. Like, love is not a weakness. Loving your enemy does not mean you love your oppression. It does not mean that you're submitting yourself to oppression. Rather, love is a strength. I mean, the logic of hate is easy to fall into. It's easy to, you know, want to destroy your enemy, to destroy the one that's oppressing you. Like for Martin Luther King points out, like that's the easy way out. Right. Rather, to love your enemy does require strength. It requires patience. It requires endurance. It requires a commitment. And so rather than something being cowardly, the way Nietzsche thought about it, love is actually something that you need to cultivate. It's something you have to exercise. And so clearly for Martin Luther King, love was an expression of strength, and it required strength to love and to want to, you know, transform a situation of oppression. And the power is necessary to that. So he recognized that, you know, the love that he was talking about, agapic love, is not a feeling. It's not simply a sentiment. It's not individualistic. Love provides or creates community. And this is where power comes from. Power comes from the community. And it is through love that community can be created. So, and I think that's the insight that he recognizes, that love can create power. Otherwise, in a situation of oppression, we're all individualized, fragmented from each other, where we cannot create community, where we cannot see each other, where, you know, there is no trust. But once love, you know, creates those relationships, creates that community, power can emerge. And that's where you can affect change on larger institutions. And so for clearly, that combination of love and power is necessary to create justice. Like, justice is not possible without love, and justice is not possible without power. You need both to create conditions for justice. And so this is where I think King sort of saw, you know, I mean, I'm not sure, it's not a necessary equation, but clearly he saw the logical connection between love, power, and justice. Like, you need love and power in order to create justice. And you can judge justice, I mean, could create, I mean, judge power by how well it's creating, you know, create relations of justice in larger society. And so I think he saw those three elements as necessarily working together within the civil rights movement in particular. Like, you needed all three to create change.
Yeah, I think, and there's where this is where we see King the philosopher and King the critical thinker. And I think he was much more those things in many ways. I mean, he was a prolific writer.
Right.
He's writing several books and multiple essays. We know he also had several people who wrote speeches for him, but he was a writer, a thinker, critical thinker, and public intellectual. And I feel like that's the piece we lose of him when we, you know, remember him every year on King Day. And, you know, as you pointed out, in some ways he refines Nietzsche's notion of the will to power and I think turns it on its head when he states, to quote King, "Power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic."
Right.
And so, like you said, you can't have one without the other. It's not a sort of either or thing. And he points out, it's almost a corrective to Nietzsche. And we don't think about King as actually within that tradition of Western philosophy, you know, as a critic of, you know, philosophers like Nietzsche and actually refining their ideas. We always miss that. We assume, I mean, in a lot of ways, Martin Luther King was a genius. Yeah. You know, he skipped several grades in K through 12. He goes to Morehouse. He's about 14, graduates at 18, goes off to Boston. Right. He has his PhD by the time he's 26.
Right.
So we forget, because there's no term for, in a conversation I recently had, the terms for Black genius don't exist. So we look at him in this reductionist way as this, you know, meek and mild preacher who was beaten in the streets and jailed and sacrificed and put his body on the line. And he did those things, but he was also a deep thinker, philosopher, and public intellectual.
Right.
And I think that we really need to, I think there must be more writing about you know, his ideas on love and his contributions to philosophy.
Yeah.
What do you think King would say about January 6th? Where would he be? Because we know there's enough been written about how radical King becomes, you know, towards the end of his life and organizing the Poor People's Campaign, and which William Barber has picked up to continue on with. And so he was, I think, critical of Vietnam War, capitalism,
right,
and more robust critiques of capitalism. So where do you think he would be if you can speculate, or what would he say to us now? And can love save us, as King saw love and defined it?
Right. Well, I mean, of course, I can't speak for him, but I think, you know, having studied his work and, you know, having taught it, I mean, I think he would clearly see that what happened on January 6th is the result of hate and ignorance. You know, it's clearly, it's people misunderstanding what's happening. But I think he would be also recognize that those people are also expressing frustration. They're expressing an anger. The question is, you know, what is the cause of that anger? You know, what is the cause of their, you know, sense of alienation from political institutions? And so on the one hand, I think he would recognize, he would be very critical of the riots, critical of the storming of the Capitol as, you know, being violent and, you know, being a form of dehumanizing the other. But I think he would also be, you know, be open to trying to understand why these people are acting in this way. And I think he would, you know, point out that, you know, there's a reason why people are acting this way. And so the issue for him, like, how do we create the conditions where people can work together to address the problems in society rather than, you know, simply act out in violent ways against politicians? And so, you know, I can love save us, that question? I think for Martin Luther King, it's, we cannot save ourselves without love. I mean, maybe love itself is not enough, but without love, we cannot save ourselves. Like, we need love to create community. We need love to create strong institutions. You know, we need love to build who we are. I mean, we need love as individuals. And so without that, transforming society would not be possible. And I think that's how you would see it. It's like, we need the love. We need the power, of course. We need justice. But without love, you know, justice would not be possible. That changing society, transforming society, you know, dealing with depression, dealing with exploitation, dealing with alienation, you know, would not, you know, cannot be fixed without first having a loving attitude to ourselves and to each other. And I think, unfortunately, the way society is structured currently, it really makes that type of love almost impossible. It hasn't extinguished it. It's still there. But people really need to work against, resist, you know, the logic of hate, the logic of, you know, of ignorance to in order to create that love. And I think for him, that's the main challenge that we find ourselves in, is to create those loving relationships, create those loving communities. And so I think he would still, you know, maintain that we cannot fall into despair, but it's going to require a lot more work, and it's going to require support from leaders throughout society, political leaders, business leaders, community leaders, to, you know, create the possibilities, you know, create the spaces for those things to happen. And unfortunately, you know, it's definitely an uphill battle at this point to create those relationships.
Yeah, I think we're losing our humanity to the machine, and or losing our humanity to Twitter. And we want to be right more than we want to be loved, I suppose.
Right.
And I think I agree with you. I think he would be cautioning us about we can't live without love. I tell my students, I said it's found in every world culture, as biological anthropologist Helen Fisher, you know, tells us, you know, it's found in every world culture that we are aware of. Right. And so I tell my students, we might be able to live without Eros, but you can't live without love. You need the love of some other human being, some collective, some family member, you know, mother, father, and there's many sources of love. Right. I try to get them to think about that too.
Yeah.
You don't find love just in one relationship. There are many sources.
Yeah. And I'm also thinking about, I mean, going back to the issue of whiteness, I mean, this is, as you pointed out previously, this is also an issue for white people. Like, what does it mean to love themselves? And if they're loving themselves as white people, then that's already a mistake in some ways. Like, whiteness is not real. And so to sort of love yourself as a white person, you have to sort of go beyond your own whiteness. And I think we're not having that conversation. Like, that question is not being posed, because to love yourself as a white person is already to sort of fall into racism, you know? And I think that's the important issue that needs to be pushed, is how can we create a loving society that goes beyond whiteness and the white identity? And I think that's the major problem of the next century.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, Christianity is a Near Eastern religion in terms of its origins. And I think we don't have too much of what Jesus of Nazareth said. We have the Sermon on the Mount. We, you know, he's talking about love of neighbor, love of, you know, family and so on. And it's about the collective. And I think what King does is he takes the Christian philosophy, theology, and he conjoins it with Eastern philosophy, mm-hmm. Gandhi, Hinduism, and love as a force, love force, Satyagraha. That, you know, this is an action, right. You know, and I think the emphasis on the collective and not the individual, right? That this is a communal thing. The beloved community, obviously, King's great dream was about the beloved community and agape, love of all humanity.
Right. You know, I kind of mentioned in my class about the influence of Gandhi in the philosophy of nonviolence, and clearly for Martin Luther King, this collective action is something that needs to be, you know, created through community. But it's, I think the issue now is, how do we do that in a fragmented society, in the society that's so fragmented as it is now? You know, clearly it was possible to bring the focus on segregation, but now we have to sort of look at the segregation of our realities. And I think it's still like continuing his project in many ways, is how do we sort of go beyond the forces of hate and ignorance that continue to shape our lives? And I think he opens up different ways to sort of to ask those type of questions. And I think really we're going to continue to need to struggle with those questions in order to deal with the issues facing our society, facing our communities.
I completely agree in why we need philosophy. You know, universities, I don't think a university can function without a philosophy program, major, department, and not now, not when we need it so much to make sense of truth and knowledge and ideas. I think that we need to talk more about this in terms of educational pedagogy and what our students need. Our students need to understand empathy. Because if they're losing their humanity to a machine, what part of the humanity are they losing, you know, the most? Is this empathy.
Right. Yeah. And as Martin Luther King pointed out, one of the reasons he promoted nonviolence is because violence not only harms the victim, but also harms the person who enacts violence. So hate not only harms the victim, but hate destroys the hater. And so it dehumanizes the hater as much as it dehumanizes the person who's being hated. And, you know, and again, for him, the only way to sort of escape that cycle is to really rethink what it means to be a person. What does, you know, in a person within the community. And philosophy, unfortunately, as you may or may not know, it's really been losing its traction throughout, you know, different universities in colleges around the nation. Like, its philosophy departments are being shut down left and right, unfortunately. And philosophers recognize that. And so part of the issue is not simply, you know, trying to resist that, but trying to bring philosophy out into the public, as you point out, like make it part of the public intellectual space, so where we can sort of think about knowledge, truth, epistemology, and, you know, asking deep philosophical questions for a large audience, you know, and sort of make it part of our popular culture in such a way that it's becomes a tool that people can use to think about themselves and think about their purpose in life. And unfortunately, you know, there's a gap between what philosophy can offer and the way philosophy is actually being discussed in larger society. And so, again, if, you know, I'm biased as a philosopher. I really hope that philosophy is recognized as having necessary value for creating a better society and, you know, to be promoted in all institutions. But it's something that, that, you know, philosophers and I myself try to promote in my classes is, you know, ultimately it's really about thinking critically about basic questions about, you know, the meaning of life, the meaning of freedom and the meaning of love. And so philosophical thinking, I think, is vital. You know, it's really tying together all the information, again, that's available on the internet, but also thinking about how is it that we're going to interpret all that information and for what purposes, with what goals, with what values. And, you know, discussion about values, you know, is already within the realm of philosophy. And I think it's something that, you know, is going to become more relevant, more important in the future. Like, what kind of society do we want to live in? What kind of world do we want to live in? So there's January 6th, but we still have this larger issue of climate change that is facing us as well, in addition to the pandemic. And so what kind of institutions do we need? What kind of government do we need to sort of deal with those larger problems? And so, yeah, and I think philosophy can sort of help to bring together the different voices and perspectives together to provide creative and constructive conversations. So
I agree with you. And I think King is a public intellectual. Really brought philosophy into the public square. So, Professor, tell us about your future teaching plans, research, anything you want to talk about before we end today.
Sure. Well, for the future, as we've been talking about the importance of teaching critical thinking. So one part of my future project involves rethinking the pedagogy of philosophy and trying to expand the curriculum of philosophy, like trying to rethink what philosophy should look like in the 21st century. Again, as philosophy departments are closing around the nation, philosophers recognize that part of the reason is that the discipline of philosophy hasn't really changed. It's very white, Eurocentric tradition. And so this current generation of philosophers is trying to change that and trying to rethink what philosophy should look like in the 21st century. So I'm trying to participate in joining that project, that larger project. And in addition to that, I'm also thinking about decolonial theory, which is a philosophy, a way of thinking that has emerged out of Latin America in the last 10, 15 years. And I'm thinking about, like, how does moral philosophy work within decolonial theory, which has tended to be dominated by, you know, epistemological questions, ontological questions. And so I'm trying to sort of figure out, okay, how does decolonial theory sort of play out when it comes to ethical questions, you know, when it actually comes out to, like, how do we, you know, relate with each other? Like, what does it mean to decolonize oneself? What does it mean to decolonize one's community, one's life, one's relationships? And so the question of decoloniality, I think, is also another question I'm pursuing as well. So they're not necessarily separate, but they are different energies going in different directions. So
look forward to the book, Professor.
Thanks.
Well, Dr. Chavez, we have taken up enough of your time today, but I want to thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. On This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture. We might have to do part two here. And the importance of philosophy in the public square. So thank you once again.